Hey, this is Dave Perner from Soul Asylum, and you are watching Life Minute TV.
He's one of the most famous faces of the Generation X scene. Grammy-winning multi-platinum artist Dave Perner and his band Soul Asylum have been rocking the music world for about 40 years now. Growing up in Minneapolis before breaking it huge in the early 90s, Perner has pretty much stayed true to his words and sounds the entire time. Eclectic, soulful, rocking, with influences all over the map, literally. Living 20 years in New Orleans has added another element to their sound. The band's currently on the road in support of their latest release, Hurry Up and Wait. We were fortunate to catch up with Perner recently while on tour to hear all about it, as well about the book he just published documenting all of Soul Asylum's work over the years, and what he thinks about what some are calling the ultimate honor, a cover of one of his songs by the late, great, fellow Minneapolis-bred Prince on his posthumously released Welcome to America album this past July. This is a Life Minute with Soul Asylum's Dave Perner.
Joanne.
Hi, Dave.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
All right, just got out of the shower.
Thanks for doing this.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You look great. This is so cool. What are you guys up to? What's the latest for Soul Asylum?
Well, we left Minneapolis on Sunday. We got to West Virginia on Wednesday and played there last night. And here we are in Myrtle Beach, the home of Kenny Powers, ready to rock Myrtle Beach, kind of just getting off the bus and out of bed and sound check. And we got, 20, 30 shows, something like that.
How does it feel to be back on the road again?
It feels pretty good. It feels like I'm still kind of getting acclimated, but everybody seems to be in pretty good shape. We got a good crew, we got a good driver, and we got all the water that we need.
It sounds good. And what can fans expect to see at a show?
Oh, about 90 minutes of quality entertainment. Old stuff, new stuff. We haven't been playing too many covers. We definitely played a couple songs last night that were new enough to us that one of them we all started off in a different song. So we had to skip that one because I think it was my fault. I think I had a capo on the guitar when I wasn't supposed to. But it was one of those brief moments on stage where it's just an absolute inner panic because no one can figure out what's going on. And we haven't really cleared that up yet, but before we went on, the guitar player and the bass player, Jeremy and Ryan, were both talking about it. Like, oh, is this the one, you use a capo on it, and then that looks like this chord for me and that chord for you, and I'm watching them, and then my whole brain just kind of went away. And we started playing it, and it was just a train wreck. You know, you try to cover for yourself. Stuff like that happens, but I think we got a laugh.
I'm sure no one noticed. I'm sure it was great. You got to give yourself a break, right? It's been a while.
This is true.
And so how's it been with Juliana, right? You guys are playing with her?
She canceled.
She did?
Yes, she did.
The whole thing? Or just
she COVID canceled.
Oh, man.
There's a lot of trepidation. So, you know, I'm disappointed. Oh. But
I didn't know that.
There's so many different ways to sort of think about this, and you can't really fault somebody for being too careful or being on the better safe than sorry side.
Yeah.
And it is kind of a, you know, like, when do I wear a mask and when do I not wear a mask? And now it's kind of this half-ass mask thing where the protocol is very confusing depending on where you are and who you're around. And, you know, nobody knows. I think that's probably the scariest part about it, is that there aren't really any concrete answers to anything.
Yeah. You can do is be as safe as you can be, I guess. Well, tell us about your latest releases.
Well, we put out a record right before the last tour. That's called Hurry Up and Wait, and it really has lived up to its title. As far as we got to San Diego, we're about 2/3 the way through our tour, and that's when I got a knock on the door. Tour's over, everything's off, go home. And I had put a book out right before that, and then we were reissuing a record called The Silver Lining with a bunch of bonus tracks on it. And then we just put out an EP of acoustic versions of some of the songs from Hurry Up and Wait, and that is called Born Free. I think that's it. You got,
what about the Prince thing? Something about the Prince.
Yes.
Yeah.
Stand up and be strong. I asked my niece how it sounded, and my niece said it was beautiful. A couple other people listened to it, and I think they were being polite, but they were telling me how much better my version was. But me and my tour manager listened to it in the car for the first time, and we did not know what was happening. So it starts off on piano, and then unbeknownst to us, a woman comes in for the first line of the song. So we were kind of like, what happened to Prince's voice? It was just the kind of a confusing moment. And then Prince comes in on the second line. You're like, oh, there he is. But he really kind of turned it into kind of a gospel feeling. And depending on who my friends are, some people seem more impressed with that than a lot of things. So it's really cool. I mean, I like his interpretation of it, and it does sounds like a Prince song. So he put his stamp on it for sure.
That's cool. Were you a Prince fan?
Well, growing up in Minneapolis, you're kind of, you almost take it for granted, I think. So it's kind of like the Beatles or something, where you're hearing it all the time and you just know it, and you don't, you know. So I have become one over time, just after watching his work ethic and how prolific he is and how just talented he is. At first, I didn't know what was going on, because we were punk rock kids, and he was walking through the 7th Street entry with his entourage while I was on stage in the little room, and I'm like, who's this guy think he is? And over time, I figured out who he thinks he is and who he is, and he's pretty great. He's always been nice to me. We worked at Paisley Park quite a bit, and he is missed, yeah.
That's cool. What was it like growing up in the fertile music scene of Minneapolis? You know, the Skidoo, Replacements, like.
It was dirty and very treacherous, and just kids behaving badly, pretty much. And it was very, I don't know if insular is the right word, but, you know, you'd play a show and the audience would be mostly people in bands. Very, very tight scene. Yet, each band had a unique identity. It was never a case where everybody sounded the same. It was kind of the opposite. Everyone was trying to do something to stick out and differentiate themselves from the other groups. So it was a lot of really kind of experimental punk rock, some extremely limited skill set, others coming up really fast and learning fast, but you know, it seems like most of the bands had no idea what they were doing, and I think that's what kind of made it so interesting. There wasn't really a palette. It wasn't like, oh, it's a metal scene and everyone has to wear their hair a certain way and everyone kind of has a similar sound. It was really the opposite of that. It was really the more screwed up you were, the more interesting it was, and the more experimental you were, you weren't afraid to take chances. And there was a lot of mistakes, a lot of things falling apart all the time, and a lot of laughs. I mean, I think that the sense of humor that was intact is something that people forget about. None of it would have been fun if people were taking it too seriously, or if it was too competitive, or if people's egos were too expanded. So yeah, you had to approach it in sort of a humble kind of way, because everyone was kind of learning what they were doing. And it makes me laugh just thinking about it. It's a folly.
Well, that's cool then. So like you were friends with the other people, like the, you know, you didn't feel competition. You felt like with the Husker dudes and was it Replacements, I guess. Like, did you feel competition or?
Not really. I mean, I think that if something good happened to a band, I mean, I like to think that everyone else was behind them, you know. And when Husker Du or the Replacements went out and got an opportunity with a record label or whatever, I think that they were kind of representing our scene in a way. Everyone was excited for them and thinking, gosh, maybe someday that will happen to my band. So I didn't feel it. I mean, I'm sure that there was people out there in bands that were really competitive and, you know, talking shit about other people's bands behind their backs and this, that, and the other thing. I'm sure it went on. Just, it's not for me. I just kind of enjoyed the whole atmosphere.
And then, so when you guys got bigger than all of them and you had your huge success, did that change you in any way, or what did that feel like?
Well, we paid off our debts. We were, you know, we've been kind of running on borrowed money and broken gear and a lot of just sort of trying to keep our heads above water. I think the best part of it is that you finally get to work in a studio and you get to choose a producer. So I'm like, well, I want to work with the guy that worked with the Ramones, and the record label's like, okay, here's Ed Stasium, we'll hire him. I want to work with the guy who works with Patti Smith, okay, Lenny Kay, here he is, you know. And that's you learn a lot, because you're spending a bunch of money in New York, and there's pressure to not screw it up. It's a huge learning experience to jump from something where you're kind of, it's a do-it-yourself kind of thing where you're just trying to sort everything out, and then all of a sudden you're in this kind of world where you're around, you know, pros, for lack of a better expression, people that have been doing it and that know how to do it. You know, there's always more to learn from people who know what they're doing. So, I mean, in a way it was long overdue, but in another way it may not have happened. We just sort of kept our heads down and kept working and doing whatever we could to get better and to get from one town to the next town and to get from point A to point B. And again, we didn't really know what we were doing. So you kind of, I guess you do what you think is best for the band. And what's good for the band is that we play a good show and at least there's a few people there that are having fun. You know?
Awesome. How has your sound evolved from the early days to now?
Well, we've had a couple changing members, and that has changed the sound in a good way. I think, you know, I've lived in New Orleans for 20 years, and that was a, it was an odyssey of learning about the music of America and where it all comes from and how it got to me. So I was able to sort of be living in New Orleans and living in living history where things were, trumpet players still kind of take cues from Louis Armstrong, and all this history is happening in front of your ears. And I just got really immersed in it. And the second line beat and the syncopation and the, I played trumpet when I was a kid, so it was really fun to finally hear what that instrument is supposed to sound like, because in Minneapolis it's kind of different. I like to say there's everyone in Minneapolis has a guitar, everyone in New Orleans has a horn. So yeah, you know, the street parades and all that sort of stuff, the culture is amazing. And I think it really just informed my music in a way that made it more manageable, because it took on more of a universal kind of a language, if you will. It's all kind of somewhere in there as far as the sound of the band is kind of evolving and going one way or the other. And then again, at the end of the day, to someone else, it just sounds like a rock band. You know, two guitars, one bass, one drummer. Same thing as the Beatles had. Same, you know, it's a fucking rock band. So to someone else, it might all sound the same, I guess.
It's so interesting to me about Nashville. It's like we're hearing that so often lately. All the best musicians, they just flock there later in life even. It's just so funny. A lot of people have been saying that to us lately. It's funny.
Yeah, I know quite a few people that have moved to Nashville, especially after Hurricane Katrina. A lot of people, engineers and studio people that were out of work. And I have quite a few friends there that are on both sides of the business, musicians and people that work in studios. And it's all that, you know. I mean, it's certainly a music town like New Orleans is. It's just a different kind of an angle. And it's definitely more, it has more access to the outside world, I think. It's more of a kind of a universal thing where there's a lot of studios and the music can get out. Whereas in New Orleans or even Minneapolis, you're just kind of where you are. So I think that that's true. And I just love it. I mean, I love walking up and down Broadway and seeing all these guitar slingers, and they're just amazing. You know, why isn't this guy, you know, on TV instead of that jerk, you know? But, yeah, just amazing players and a great atmosphere for musicians.
That's cool. What inspires you to create? And has that changed at all over the years?
No, I mean, I think it's kind of a cathartic sort of a thing. I don't really wonder why I do it, but it seems like I would do it anyways. Like if I lived in a hole under a rock, I'd probably still be writing little tunes and drawing little pictures and doing all this kind of stuff that I do for no apparent reason. So yeah, I sit up on the bus and I do some writing and I do some drawing and I mess around with my, I went to Target before we went on tour and got some art supplies, and it really keeps my brain activated in a way where I am always trying to come up with something new or something that pleases me. And after that, I don't really pay that much attention to it, which is kind of a strange way of going about it. You know, I'm making a painting, but I don't really care if anybody else sees it. And that's kind of similar with the music. although, you know, it pretty much helps if somebody else is going to hear it at some point. Otherwise, I'm wasting everybody else's time.
What'd you get at Target? Watercolors or?
I got some Sharpie paint pens. I got some little acrylic paints. I did get some watercolors, and I got, you know, brushes, cheap brushes. I can't afford to buy really nice brushes and then lose them or forget to wash them or whatever. So what I didn't buy was Mod Podge, which is one of my favorite things, but I'm pretty sure my tour manager would not want that all over the bus. I think that's about it, you know, a decent size notebook for drawing and some colored pencils, you know, stuff like that.
Very cool. So that's what you do when you're not making music, artwork.
Different. Pretty much, yeah. Yep.
Cool. Very cool. And tell us a little bit more about your book.
Well, I didn't really get to go out and promote it, and I don't know how much I would have enjoyed that, you know, sitting at a bookstore and feeling like a dumbass. It was a journey through the past, kind of, you know, just writing out every lyric. My tour manager, Janine, helped me with it, and just kind of trying to take myself back to when I wrote the song and what was going on in my brain. And sometimes it was kind of embarrassing, but other times I was like, hey, you know, that's not bad for a 19-year-old. So it was good. It was kind of, it felt like going backwards a little bit, just reliving my life of songwriting. The joke that we make is that it's a lonely life, the life of a writer. I think it came out really good in a way that I never thought I would put a book out. I mean, so I can make jokes about it pretty easily. Like, you know, I'm a published author now, so rude-a-toot toot, you know.
Very cool. What would your current self say to your 19-year-old self?
Probably stay in school. You know, don't hang around with those kids, and get a real job, and then you'll have something to fall back on. Yeah, I don't. You know, I mean, go live your dream, man. Do whatever it is that you feel like you want to. Too, because I mean, I don't know. I guess it's worked out.
Yeah, a lot of, I think so.
You know, sacrifices that were made and choices that maybe weren't the best choices, but you know, at some point or another, I had to pick the band or school, and I picked the band, and here I am.
Yeah, it worked out for us. I'm glad you
did. I think I'd be really miserable in some of the other jobs I might have ended up in. You know.
Did you always know you wanted to be in music even when you were little?
I did, actually. I mean, unbeknownst to me, I think there's pictures of me when I'm 5 years old playing drums and playing guitars, and I remember always being really into it. Like, that's just where my brain was at. And I think, you know, it's probably somewhat amusing and somewhat concerning for mom and dad. But yeah, I mean, like, my next door neighbor got an electric guitar, and I was all of probably 8. And I remember it like very vividly. And I just wanted to play that thing so badly. And there is a photo. And I do look like I'm gonna fucking take this seriously, even though I'm 7 years old. I'm like, yeah.
Aw, that's so cute. And today is vinyl record day. So what was the first vinyl you ever had?
45 or LP?
Either one.
I think, let's see.
Both. I actually want to know both.
I think the 45 was Smoke on the Water. And I think the LP, my older sister had a lot of LPs. I think the first one I bought for myself was Captain Fantastic.
Wow, that one, Jen.
Yeah.
Was he one of your influences? Who were some of your influences?
Deep Purple. It seems like there's kind of a music side and a word side. So I mean, the music thing. When I was a kid, I was into jazz music, trumpet players, and then my taste in that turned from people like Maynard Ferguson and people that could play the highest note to like Miles Davis. You kind of start to realize that it's not a, music isn't a sport, an athletic endeavor. So, you know, and then there's the radio kind of period where you're just listening to whatever's on the radio, going to Shopper City and buying the 45 that's on the radio. I remember my mom went to it was this place called Zaire's Shopper City, which is like a discount store, kind of like Target. And I said, "Oh, Mom, you gotta get this 45 for me." And she'd say, "Well, what's the name of it?" And I'd sing it to her. And then she would go to Shopper City and not, she'd have to sing it to the and I wasn't there for that, but I think that would have been pretty amusing.
Did they know what it was?
Yeah.
Did they help her? What was it?
Yeah. There was one called "When You're Hot, You're Hot." And "When You're Not, You're Not." There was one called "Winchester Cathedral." I just visualizing my mother singing that to a clerk is pretty hilarious to me. And then I kind of got more into hard rock. I had a Kiss period that I'm not particularly proud of.
Nothing wrong with Kiss.
Yeah. In high school, I was still playing the trumpet, and then I switched to saxophone because, you know, Bruce Springsteen and Bob Seger and people like that had a saxophone in their band. And then I finally realized that I was listening to Jimi Hendrix a lot and going, I'm just going to learn how to play guitar. And then I heard the Ramones and a couple other punk bands and went, oh, you know, maybe I can do this. Yeah. And then on the other side of it, there's the Velvet Underground, Lou Reed and Leonard Cohen and Bob Dylan and, you know, who I consider to be the great lyricists of our time, if you will. So that kind of informs things too, and hopefully it ends up sounding like something.
Anybody from today that you listen to that you like?
I got into this band called Cage the Elephant.
Oh yeah,
they're pretty good. And I like those Tiny Desk concerts on NPR. They got real interesting music, and I like that I can see a lot of live music now on YouTube, which is something that you couldn't do back in the day, you know. Yeah, I'm not doing great on this one. I just bought a magazine about Aaliyah. I really was a fan of hers. So I like hip hop. I like Kendrick Lamar. I like rock, 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 rock. I like Pantera.
Oh, me too.
So,
You're
it's
very
kind of
diverse.
keeping up with people before it's too late, it seems like.
That was the next thing I was going to ask you. What do you think of the way music's changed? Do you think it's for the better, for the worst? How, we can stream everything and.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, like I said about the YouTube thing, that's really cool, and it's so much better to me than MTV and kind of watching people lip sync and stuff. To see people actually playing the instruments is great. I hate MP3s. I think they sound terrible. So that always kind of turned me off. And I was really kind of like, okay, now I gotta buy these CDs and formats and this, that, and the other thing. It was getting very frustrating. And then kind of vinyl came back, and now I just listen to records all the time. And it's really, I could have skipped those 25 years between vinyl and vinyl, where all this nonsense is going on with trying to. I mean, I guess I get the convenience factor of it all, but it's not really for people that love music and people that, are serious about it. It's more like background kind of noise.
Yeah, it's true. Dave, thank you so much. That
Thank
was a
you.
great interview. You sounded awesome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Janine, and good luck on the tour. Be safe and enjoy
See
it.
you someday.
Hope
Right,
so. Thanks,
thanks,
Dave.
Joanna.
Thank you. Have a good show.
Thank you.
To hear more of this interview, visit our podcast, Life Minute TV, on iTunes and all streaming podcast platforms. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Life Minute TV.